This webcast is made possible in part by support from the listener members of the Classical Network, WWFM and WWFM.org. Thank you for your support. So here we are, Rob Capello, and these young musicians have positioned us for a complete performance of Franz Schubert's Symphony No. 8 in B minor, the Unfinished Symphony. But we're going to take a few moments to visit with the three maestri who deal with these young musicians weekly, and they are respectively the music directors of the three youth orchestras represented on this program. John Enns from the Youth Orchestra of Central Jersey, Robert Lauren, the music director of the Youth Orchestra of Bucks County, PA, and Kawika Kahalahoe, the music director of the Greater Princeton Youth Orchestra. Gentlemen, first of all, I want to thank you for making this incredible evening possible. Just a general thank you for allowing your musicians to be part of this and doing such hard work behind the scenes to make sure there was an orchestra on stage tonight.
Sure.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Awesome.
It is awesome. It's going to be a great evening, and we're looking forward to the second half. So you deal with these young musicians, these very talented teenage young musicians. Two sides of a coin. What's the rewarding aspects of making music with musicians of this age?
It's really interesting watching them, the learning process, because for us, we understand the music from, you know, an educated perspective. We've all have a extensive music education and a higher understanding of the art form. And then you watch a student who really only understands it from the vantage point of their part. And when they start to open up their ears and hear the entirety of it and understand the piece or sort of analyze the piece from an aural perspective, you see light bulbs go on, and that's really cool.
I think that especially rewarding to experience their sense of optimism. They're teenagers and they have, you know, great sense of what could be, the great possibilities of life, not just music, but of life. And when they experience a work, this great Schubert Unfinished, they approach it with just eyes wide open, ears wide open. And it's exciting for us, I think, as music directors, to get to that point.
It's a great thing to see how, you're absolutely right, you know, to see them grow from a standpoint of the scale.
Yeah.
And go from there to da dum da dee.
Yes.
You know,
mm-hmm.
it's
yeah.
You know, like a melody that
right.
that cellos live for.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And that we all come together with Schubert, who was so young and came up with such mature and vivid ideas
yeah.
in music. And to see them bring their kind of early perspective, you know, as a student, and see it mature into an emotional, quantitative expression is just amazing. And that's the reward that I certainly get from this. You know, it's just to see them first realize they're out of tune, and then next, that rhythm, aha. And then they put it together
right.
correctly.
Okay.
And in the community of the orchestra.
Yeah.
And whoa, then we just, you can't do that with a professional as easily.
Right. So, now, you're a cellist, right, John?
Yeah. That,
okay.
How could you tell?
Well, I don't play cello, so that melody to me meant I've got my down a perfect fourth nailed. That's what it meant for me for ear training. That's what I used to do my perfect fourth. Schubert goes down a fourth, and then you got it.
Oh.
So there you go. So let's flip the coin. I mean, this is rewarding. You guys get to see these light bulbs sort of go on each week with some of the music you program and as you rehearse these kids. There are challenging aspects to making music with musicians of this talent, yet this age. So the other side, just what can be a challenge? What do you have to work on? What do you have to keep going over and molding with these kids?
I mean, I think it's very easy to say that the student's ability level is challenging. You know, some of our orchestras have a very wide range of ages. I mean, the thing that challenges me the most is really how much demand is placed on the students outside of the group, and they come with so much baggage to rehearsal, which is great because I think they get to kind of forget about all that baggage. But the time in which we're doing this concert, they have AP exams. How many of them are on the stage doing this concert thinking, I have an AP exam tomorrow?
Mm-hmm.
It's like calculus AB or BC or one of these ridiculous exams that are happening tomorrow, and here they are on stage doing this. So I think that it's challenging and definitely commendable to the students for, you know, investing their time when they have so little of it.
It's absolutely so true. I mean, you know, the AP thing, I had a student the other day at rehearsal with their instrument, but on the other side of the instrument on the music stand was their laptop going on at the same time. Now, concurrently, you know, that worked out well. Why? Because during rests, they were able to sort of, you know, focus that way. But it's a reality, and we want to honor that because our students are high-achieving students, and they bring that aspect of high achievement to youth orchestras. So we do want to endorse that aspect, but it is a challenge that way.
The challenge is met, I think, by the students as they learn time management, and that's very good. But it seems like there's more and more things being heaped onto these schedules. I look back on my youth, and I had nothing of this kind of pressure.
Yeah.
I mean, did you get any of that?
It's very true, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, fact that we were able to take more than one music class in school, I say that to students, and they're like, how did you do that? Didn't you have this requirement? I had no. I think I dropped all of my classes that weren't music my senior year.
John, that's a great segue into my next question. The next question was going to be is, what did music play in the three of your lives at this age, which means what can you give to these kids? How can you put themselves in your shoes? Now, Kawika, you actually played in the Youth Orchestra of Bucks County in Bob's group, so there's that mentoring there. But when you were this age, what was music to you? What were you doing that you can relate to these young musicians?
Music was one of the few things I was very good at. And for high school students, you know, the life in high school is extremely difficult. You know, they're all looking for their corner of the school where they're comfortable and where they feel like they're part of something, where they kind of fit in. And they're coming from a middle school environment where it's a little more nurturing. And now they're thrown into high school where there's so much demand placed on them. And they're so forward thinking about college. And, you know, every wrong step could be catastrophic. So for me, our area, our specialty is kind of like, you know, it's a place where they can... where they can feel comfortable. It's a place where they can feel like they have a place where they're special, you know, where they're really valued. Because, you know, it's hard to get that from a lot of your classes in school. You know, you may see a teacher for 1 year and then you're on to another teacher. But with a group like a youth orchestra, that could span for 6 years. I have students who are in my top youth orchestra who started in our preparatory group when they were in fifth grade. And have been doing it for 8 or 9 years. So I'd know this student better than any of their teachers.
Yeah, you've watched them grow.
Yeah.
The only person outside of that would be their parents who've watched them grow like that. Yeah.
It's great just because we're able to give opportunities to our students to be able to find their passions. For me, you know, I was interested in many different academic subjects, but it was music that really sort of clicked with me. And once I found that, there was no turning back. That's what I'm looking for us as educators, to be able to supply that opportunity to maybe, oh my goodness, have that really special moment so kids can find that and maybe pursue that and just enjoy the heck out of it, you know?
I didn't have that youth orchestra experience in my youth. The nearest one was 2 hours away.
Okay.
Maybe a little less than that, in Indiana. It was something that was quite different. I heard a cellist when my mother was accompanying this cellist, and I really loved it. And my father showed me his viola and gave me a first lesson, so to speak.
Wow.
And that was when I was very young. And then in fourth grade, they had a string program that just started in my school.
Okay.
And I got to grow out of that. And it was such an experience because I wanted, as a young person, to sing the bass line in the hymns at church.
Okay.
My voice would never do that, but now I had a cello that could do that. And that was the beginning of that kind of passion, to be part of that hymn, to be part of the music, the foundation of that song. And I learned so much from that. Then growing up into high school, it's indicative of it was just a budding orchestra program. But the band, the marching band in Indiana is phenomenal. It's like a culture unto itself.
Mm-hmm.
And it had a lot of things to offer. And you go into the band room's library, and it was as big as this room that we're being interviewed. And it was filled with all kinds of filing cabinets.
Right.
And the two filing cabinets in the closet in the other side was where the orchestra sort of had their music with a few empty drawers.
Right.
And I felt, well, something's not right here. It's not equal.
Okay.
And so I began to think that wouldn't it be good to have, you know, equal footing? And that's the basis kind of where our youth orchestra grew out of at West Windsor. We worked together with the band program, the choir program.
Right.
And we just have one big joyful noise.
Very good.
You were never destined to play the oboe, John. You were just never, it was just not, destiny was not calling you to that woodwind section. So, you know, Kawika, you mentioned how some of your students you've had for such a long time, and I know it's the case with YLBC, and I'm sure it's the case with YLCJ. Yet, the fact is, even that child who you've seen for 7 or 8 years, so much has changed for kids this age, and for everybody, but for kids this age, they are so different than kids were 5 years ago, 10 years ago. Technology plays a huge role in that. What have you seen as changes over your 10 years of the kids you were making music with 5 years ago and 10 years ago and 15 and 20? What are some of those really major changes in these young musicians due to the world we live in now, 2017?
You're right. The students are vastly different. I've been teaching for 16 years. There's like those 5-year chunks and they kind of change every couple of years. I think what's a little unfortunate is that students and education has led students to sort of think this way, but there seems to be like a drive to sort of learn something and have a definite answer. It's almost like binary. So when they approach music, I don't think they understand a lot of times that the answer is a lot more complex. And what's really neat is they have all these classes where they're being taught facts and dates and a methodology of how to arrive at an answer, where they sit down in our groups, I think they start to understand an aesthetic appreciation, which has been something that's really lacking in high school. So I could see, like, you know, years ago, there was a greater investment in that, or even a higher understanding. And that's sort of becoming diluted, especially with technology, because I think maybe 10 years ago, students used technology, but they would go to other sources. Now, technology is such a huge component of their life. I mean, they get TV through technology. They communicate through technology. We communicate talking to each other. My students can have the most elaborate conversation. They're never saying a word. So, you know, kids are different. And the way that plays itself out, you know, in music is challenging and also different.
You know, there's the thing called social media, and, you know, our kids are not immune to that at all. In fact, quite heavily invested. But our orchestra rehearsals give them a chance to step away from that a little bit. Obviously, you know, phones are away, but, you know, once in a while, they still, they're, quote, maybe, shall I say the word, addicted? Because that's a reality. But we give them an opportunity to be able to say, ah, here's something else in life to be able to latch onto. And I think, Kawika, you're absolutely right. The aesthetic appreciation that we are able to expose them to is unusual and unique and very special. But the plus side of this electronic world, which they're hooked up to, is something called YouTube. My goodness, the resource. The resource that our students have.
And teachers. You know,
and teachers. Oh, my goodness. It's fantastic. And for us to use that, be able to use that, is a real gift, I think. So.
Well, I've seen you in rehearsals, Bo, where you say, okay, go YouTube this. Which is like, so go to the library and find a recording. It's go YouTube this. Yeah. And within seconds, they have. So.
Yeah. The other thing that I think is the students have garnered, and I think what Suzuki has given us has changed a little bit our music education perspective. And so I think what has happened is that in the string community, students have started earlier, of course, and they have more experience by the time they get into like middle school and high school, that music that was, you know, deemed too hard for high school is now very approachable.
Yeah.
And I think it's not just the strings, because this drives also the interest when they see their friends playing Vivaldi's concerto in A minor. They can tell that they're just really getting into it. Mm-hmm. And I see flute players and the woodwinds, the oboes, okay, playing with a much higher level of musicianship at a younger age at this stage.
Well, this joy of music that these kids have at this age, a great part of it goes to the three of you and the organizations you head and of which you are music directors. And I want to thank you for that. We are going to look forward to this complete performance of the Schubert as played by these young musicians. And I know that as they play these notes and they play that great cello theme, John, and just this great masterpiece by Schubert, I know all three of you have great pride in what you're hearing. So thank you for the work you do.
Thanks, David.
Thank you.
Back here live at Princeton High School for the second half of this special What Makes It Great with host Rob Capello, as he will now lead this special all-star youth orchestra made up of select musicians from the Youth Orchestra of Central Jersey, the Greater Princeton Youth Orchestra, the Youth Orchestra of Bucks County, and Princeton High School in a complete performance of Franz Schubert's Symphony No. 8 in B minor, The Unfinished. Mr. Capo now asking individual soloists in the orchestra to receive their applause from this audience here at Princeton High School Auditorium. And the concertmaster Dallas Noble asks the entire orchestra to rise and acknowledge the applause of those here in attendance. Just heard the host of What Makes It Great, composer, conductor, author, commentator Rob Capello lead an all-area, all-star youth orchestra made up of young musicians grades 9 through 12 from the Youth Orchestra of Central Jersey, Greater Princeton Youth Orchestra of Bucks County, and Princeton High School. There are a number of people we wish to thank for making this broadcast possible. From Princeton High School, Patrick Lenahan, Peggy Thompson, Jeffrey Van Velser. From Youth Orchestra of Central Jersey, John Enns, Larissa Epps, and Jason Method. They can be found at yocj.org. The Greater Princeton Youth Orchestra, Kawika Kahalahoe and Minnie Krishnan. They can be found at gpyo.org. Youth Orchestra of Bucks County, Robert Warren, Colleen Sweetser, Diana Nolan. They can be found at yobc.org. Colbert Artist Managements, Lee Prince and Zoe Hart. Chris Pastor from the Classical Network, Marcia Calambos, Alice Weiss, and Ross Amico. Our audio recording engineers of Sam Weiss and John Baker of John C. Baker Recordings, LLC. And our video engineers tonight, David Walters from the Classical Network, Rachel Katz, and Ashley Batansis. And, of course, our listener members of the Classical Network. Let's head back to the stage now of Princeton High School for our closing Q&A session with Rob and these young musicians with questions from those in attendance here. So we can turn this over to you, Rob.
Chance of a lifetime. Who's got a question for anyone on stage? Chance of a lifetime. Yes, go ahead, right over there. Hold on, here comes a microphone.
You were going to, from the lecture, play the third movement. Are we going to hear any of that?
Yes, we're going to play the, I promise you that we will, before the end of the night, play the 20 measures. But we have to keep everybody hanging, and it's our little teaser to make sure that you stay till the bitter end. But we will play those 20 measures, and you can decide if it was worth the wait. I promise you we will. Anyone else? Here's a rare chance. Whole orchestra on stage. Go ahead.
I would like to know how long the musicians have been working with each other and how long you have been working with them.
How long have the musicians been working with each other? Who wants to take that? Okay, good, back there, 1 second. That's what we like, willing brass players. Okay, go ahead.
All right, hi everyone, my name is Nick. I'm the bass trombonist from the Youth Orchestra of Central Jersey. To answer your question, how long have you been working together? We found out when this was happening a few months ago, but the first time we met was actually last Sunday, April 30th, in Bucks County, Pennsylvania. We've had a few rehearsals since then, and today was by far the longest. We've been here since 5 o'clock, almost 5 hours now. But
he's
it's
happy about it.
Yeah, I'm really happy about it. It's great that you guys all came out. Thank you for listening.
Great. Have any of the other orchestras been working on this any longer than that? Any of the other orchestras been working on it longer? And actually, I met them a long time ago, yesterday night. I met them last night, and we had a rehearsal last night for 2.5 hours, and then today, as part of that long 5-hour marathon, we had an hour and a half rehearsal today. But most of the 5 hours was spent with them eating pizza, as far as I could tell. But, you know, the real answer to that question is actually a more complex answer, and I'm going to tell a story that I've told before at What Makes It Great, and I apologize for repeating myself, but it's a good one for them to hear. And it's the story of Picasso's napkin. When Picasso was 85 years old, he was in a cafe, and this woman came up to him, and she said, "Oh, maestro, I've loved your painting. Would you mind just sketching something very quickly for me on a napkin?" And he said, "Oh, absolutely, no problem." And she gave him a cocktail napkin, and he went and drew this terrific picture of a dove in about 10 seconds. And she said, "Thank you so much." And he said, "That'll be $85,000. And she says, "But it only took you 10 seconds. And he said, "No, it took me 85 years. So the question of how long they've been playing together is not really simply a question when they got together a week ago in Bucks County. It's all the time that they've put in on all the other projects other than this. It's all the countless hours that they've spent in their own practice rooms rather than having the social life that they're supposed to have. It's all that time on the weekends that these wonderful conductors have spent training them. So it's not really just a question of how long have they worked on this program. It's the 85 years that they don't look a day over 84. It's the 85 years that they've actually spent by themselves on their instrument, with each other, and with their conductors being prepared to actually do this in such a short time that made it possible. Anyone else? Rare opportunity.
We're going to move from the brass section forward. We have a question that came in on Facebook. Ask a woodwind player, what challenges do you face in this piece?
Oh, ask the woodwind players, what challenges do you face in this piece, other than me? Okay. Who would like to answer that one? There's a chance of a lifetime. Good, good. Okay.
Probably the biggest challenge that I personally face is that reeds are very unpredictable. So one day you'll have a reed that's like perfectly good, and then the next day it's completely trash. So.
Anyone else want to, any other challenges that you guys face in the woodwind section? Anyone else? No problem for them, I guess. No, it's true. When you're a woodwind player, your entire life is spent with reeds. I mean, basically, the whole idea of music is to avoid a real life and do something else. Either in a practice room, or you're restringing, or you're actually doing reeds, but it's just an immense lifetime activity doing reeds. Worst for oboe, probably, I would say. I mean, they definitely have the worst, but it's pretty bad for clarinet, too. Yes, your whole life is about reeds. Yes, over here, go ahead.
Yes, sir. I'm sort of asking maybe a stupid question, I'm not sure.
This is the place to ask stupid questions. There are no stupid questions.
I've done some composition myself, and I've had some courses, and I've had some performance of my compositions. It's been from my heart as much as anything else, and I have not analyzed the way that you have discussed today. Are these greats in history? Do they just do that from their heart? Do they figure this out, or do they say, oh, gee, I should change that to a seventh instead of a sixth and that kind of thing? I know
great.
That's a dumb
my favorite question. Basically, the question is, was I making all this stuff up? And is this all real garbage, and do the real guys just write from their heart? And the answer is both yes and no. And I'll answer it for you in a very simple way, because it's a really, really good question. When I'm speaking to you now in English, am I thinking subject, object, verb, agreement? Absolutely not. I'm fluent in the language of English, and all of that happens. If I were to look back at a conversation or a poem or even a letter that I wrote, I could go back and analyze that, and I would discover all the things that we are discussing here. So the truth is, when you're good at anything, the whole process of getting good at anything is learning something consciously and then doing it unconsciously. So, for example, I was a tennis pro when I was in college, and that's how I put myself through a lot of music programs. And when I would teach someone, I would break it down extremely analytically. You would step, you would transfer your weight, you would plant, you would pivot, racket, and you would actually explain it very clearly. By the time you're actually good at it, you don't have to think about it. So the whole process of learning anything, whether it's composition, gardening, cooking, a foreign language, I mean, I've learned like about 5 or 6 languages, because whenever I go somewhere, I like to learn the language. At the beginning, it's always incredibly rote-like, and you have to remember subjects and objects. As you get good at it, you do it effortlessly. So the truth is, a great composer or a great poet actually doesn't have to think about it consciously, usually, because it's already so ingrained, and that's the process of mastery. I will tell you this, the times when I think about it most analytically are when I get in trouble. It's the same thing, like if you're writing a speech and it doesn't sound exactly right, that's when you start analyzing your speech and you think, well, why does that sound bumpy? And you suddenly say, well, there's a bunch of short phrases, I need some long ones, that's a run-on sentence. So on occasions when you have trouble, you become very, very analytically. But the truth is, mostly you don't have to think about it only because you've become a master at it. That doesn't mean it's not happening, and if you were to look at it afterwards, you could actually point all that out. So you don't have to think about it consciously because you've already learned how to do it unconsciously. Good question. Yes. But no, I promise you, Schubert was not going, aha, I'll add the seventh. But you know, it's just the way you hear. Just like, I'll give you one last example. You know, take poetry, Robert Frost, Fire and Ice. Some say the world will end in fire, some say in ice. From what I've tasted of desire, I hold with those who favor fire. Now, I promise you, he didn't go, some say the world will end in fire, 4, aha, I better vary it and not go, from what I've tasted up to, and do another 4. But he goes, you know, some say the world will end in fire, 4. Some say in ice, 2. Now he's got a pattern. From what I've tasted of desire, 4. He could have gone, I favor fire. But he goes, I hold with those who favor fire. Now, I don't think he necessarily counted 4, 2, 4, surprise, surprise, haha, 4. But that's the way you hear when you're a great poet. You just notice those things effortlessly. If you look back at it, it's very easy to analyze it. Anyone else? We got all these people on stage. Here's your chance of a lifetime.
Is it different to rehearse for an explanatory performance like this than for a purely aesthetic performance?
Yeah, I like the distinction between an explanatory performance or an aesthetic performance. Assuming that the explanatory one is completely unaesthetic. Yes, it's completely different. In fact, you know, playing those musical examples is in many ways much harder than playing the piece. I mean, you have to start in the middle of nowhere. They have absolutely no idea. They've never heard me say anything in between before. All they hear is blah, 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 and then they play blah, 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 blah. That's what they get at rehearsal. So playing those excerpts completely out of context, starting from nowhere, it's much, much harder to play them. They have it all written out for them, but yes, I would say, wouldn't you say that the examples are in some ways harder to play than the piece itself? Yeah, it's very difficult to just start on a dime, particularly if you have like a very hard solo and all of a sudden, out of no context, you just have to start. So yes, the whole process is much different, and we spent more time actually rehearsing the first half of the show with the musical examples than the piece itself.
Anyone else? Last chance.
One more. Yes, go ahead. In the red.
Thank you. I was just curious to know how many of you who are juniors or seniors right now plan to pursue music as a career, or perhaps you're going to study classically when you go to college.
How many juniors and seniors in the orchestra plan on going on in music, at least in college? Oh, okay. And how many juniors and seniors do not? Oh, okay, so most of you. Okay, that's right. So he's ostracized. That's it. He's out of the orchestra. Okay, good. Do we have any one last question while we're here? Oh, yes, over here, right here, down here.
Hi, I read that a few years after Schubert's death, Schumann discovered most of the symphonies on the bookshelves of Schubert's brother. So I'm curious why this one took so long to be discovered.
Actually, most of his pieces took a long time to be discovered. You know, when Schubert died, he was pretty much exclusively known as a song composer. The pieces that were really popular were songs he wrote, and also he wrote lots of dances and four-hand piano music that was really popular. But at the time, songs were considered like a minor genre. Like, it wasn't serious. I mean, it was like, if you want to be a serious person, you write a novel. You don't write a book of essays or something like that. Lieder was really sort of a low version, and so he wasn't taken seriously. Most of his major instrumental works, symphonies, chamber music, weren't known until much after, and they were spread out all over different places. He died too young, and he just didn't actually get his music out there. So that was one of the reasons why he wasn't more famous, was actually people just didn't know it. So it was all in different places. Schumann discovered it, Mendelssohn discovered it, friends kept it for themselves. In fact, this piece was kind of used as a ransom. The way it actually finally got performed was Anselm Huttenbrenner gave it to this conductor, Herbeck, under the condition that Herbeck would play one of his own pieces at the same concert as the unfinished symphony, and that's how he got it. So they played a horrible overture by Anselm Huttenbrenner at the same concert as the unfinished symphony. So, you know, you use your resources wisely. But the music really took quite a long time for Schubert's work to actually even be known to the general public. They had no idea when he died that he wrote all these symphonies and amazing chamber pieces.
I have a question.
Yes, go ahead. Yes.
In the program, it says that there is a complete piano version of the scherzo. Is that the thing we're going to hear, the 12 measures?
There is sketch of the whole third movement for piano, but he orchestrated only 20 measures.
So has anyone ever tried to orchestrate it?
Oh, yes. The whole process of finishing the unfinished symphony for a while was a cottage industry. In 1928, there was actually a competition for who could write the best version of it, and all of them were bad. But there are many, many, many continuations of them. After a while, most of them were bad, and so they decided to write pieces that were homages to the unfinished symphony because it was very, very hard to actually finish it. But there are many, many versions that have tried to finish the entire piece as well. Yes. Mm-hmm. But we'll play the... You want to hear it right now? You want to hear it? Okay. So it's just 20 measures long, and this is what the third movement orchestration sounds like. You've got all your fragments out there? And you can decide whether that was too much or not enough.
One more time.
What?
One more time.
You want to hear it one more time?
Yeah.
One more time, all right. I promise you'll never hear it again. But you will notice that it starts in a minor key, and then just like the Love and Pain, changes to a major key when the oboe plays the theme. Classic Schubert. Here we go. One more time. It. And I think, is that our last, that we have to stop?
I think it's a good way we end with Schubert that wasn't,
Schubert in an unfinished night. One final thought I will just say, you know, in my book, the last chapter is called Finished versus Complete, and it's about the difference between something that's finished, meaning done or ended, the concert is finished, and something that's complete, meaning whole or entire, as my life was complete, I've been to a What Makes a Great program. You can decide whether or not the unfinished symphony is actually unfinished or complete, because though it's unfinished, obviously it was intended to be a four-movement symphony, in some ways when it comes to the end, I do feel that it's poetically complete. And on that note, I just want to thank these fantastic young musicians and their conductor for making this wonderful evening. One more bow for the orchestra. And their conductors, would you please come out? Conductors. There are three conductors.
Robert Lorne from Youth Orchestra Bucks County, Kawika Kahalahoe from the Greater Princeton Youth Orchestra, and John Ed.
They're the ones
Youth
who made
Orchestra
it possible.
Of Central Jersey. And with that, we will bring this very special episode of What Makes It Great to a close. It will be available as a webcast 1 week from today on our website, wwfm.org. For Rob Kaplow, for this orchestra of young musicians, and for all here at Princeton High School, I'm David Ozenbrook saying thank you to all here in attendance. This Celebrating Our Musical Future and What Makes It Great, an exclusive production of the award-winning Classical Network and WWFM.org.
You've been listening to a rebroadcast of our Live from Princeton, What Makes It Great, which was recorded just this past Monday at Princeton High School. If you enjoyed this What Makes It Great with Rob Kaplow about the Schubert Unfinished Symphony, if you enjoyed the fact that these young musicians, grades 9 through 12, got a chance to perform this great masterpiece and work with someone of the caliber of Rob Kaplow, we ask you to support what you've heard. Go to our website, wwfm.org, and make a donation now in membership to ensure that programs like this can continue. I am David Ozenbrook, and I will leave you with a little music of Schubert. Music Schubert composed when he was the same age as these young musicians as we've heard tonight. One of his five German dances with trio, Deutschlisting 90, composed when he was 17, performed by the Festival Strings Lucerne. I'm David Ozenbrook. Have a great evening.